Hey guys, it's Charlie, and welcome to another episode of Talking to Charlie. So let me paint the picture. Rewind 2 weeks ago, and you may recall we had Andrew on the show talking to us about all things nutrition and cancer. Well, in between now and then, he flew back to the UK before then returning to Portugal. And if by pure chance, he found himself sitting next to today's guest, had it not been for them introducing themselves to each other on the flight, well, quite frankly, we wouldn't actually find ourselves here today at all. So I'm going to call it fate, if you like. Now, to say that today's guest has had quite the story, quite frankly, that would just be a massive understatement. She truly is an absolute inspiration to us all, and I cannot wait to get started. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome Lucy to the show. Lucy, hi.
Hi, Charlie.
How are we doing? All good?
Yep, very good, thank you. Very good.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time to see us. I did, I have alluded to our listeners that this is a sort of a bit of a coincidence because it just just so happens that you were sat on the same flight as my previous guest, Andrew. And if by chance, sat next to each other, started chatting. Andrew alluded to this show, exception otherwise, and alluded to your story, which we're going to get into more detail now. And here we are. So, yeah, as I say, great to have you. But just for the benefit of our listeners, can you just tell us a little bit more about Lucy on a day to day? Just who you are? It's not a job interview, by the way.
I'm a 61-year-old woman. I spent 35 years running a production company for sort of large scale events in London, which became increasingly stressful. So I moved to Portugal a while ago. And then 5 years ago, I had a sort of traumatic thing happen, which made me even more stressed. But what I found is that I knew even 15 years ago that stress was not ideal and that I needed something more peaceful, and Portugal provided that.
Well, I can adhere to that or testify to that, because for those who don't know, I also live in Portugal, so it's not a bad spot, is it? So you mentioned 5 years ago. When you said something changed, something happened in your life.
Well, 5 years ago, my eldest son, who had been in the army, collapsed, paralyzed from the waist down. And it was a very frightening time because we didn't know what was wrong with him. So obviously one fears the worst. And I really did shut down and go into shock. I was still running the BAFTA Film Awards red carpet side, so that was quite stressful in itself. And then I had my son in hospital, and my other son at school, and so I was commuting between two countries and hospital and work.
And the
BAFTAs, which I loved, but it was still a responsibility. And I really did. I know that I shut down at the time. There were a lot of signs of how stressed I was physically.
And what sort of signs might they be, just to sort of give us a bit of a steer? Without giving too much detail.
I was weeing blood, but without having any infection. I was literally, nobody could work out why.
So what was it then that sort of drove you? I mean, weeing blood, I think, is enough for anyone to sort of go, hold on. So something's not quite right here. But I think you mentioned to Andrew, it was post-Brexit, was it?
That I found my own issues because I had to switch my driving license for a Portuguese driving license. And to do that, you have to do a medical. And I had an excellent doctor here, GP doctor, who did a very broad spectrum of tests for this. And on this flagged up that there was a problem. And he then sent me to have a colonoscopy. I mean, I've condensed this. This took 3 months, actually, to do.
What are they trying to identify in the blood test from a renewing your driving license perspective?
Well, no, I think what it was, one has to have a full medical to see that it's like
just
having an
MOT.
They're not looking for cancer, but what came up in the test was that there was something not right, so he sent me for further tests. And what transpired from that was that I had got colon cancer. It didn't seem that serious on the first scan on the colonoscopy, but they sent me for further scans the next week and found that I actually, not only did I have this little tiny tumour in my colon, but I had 14 tumours in my liver and one in my lung. So I was actually stage four. What was interesting too was that in 2019, just before Alexander had collapsed, I'd actually had some blood tests looking for cancer because a friend of mine had thought I had some edema in my legs, very slight, but it turned out to actually be rheumatoid arthritis and not cancer. So I had had these marker tests. Right. And I'd also been thrown off my horse. So my liver had been scanned because I'd broken my ribs, and that whole area was scanned to make sure my broken ribs weren't going to pierce my spleen and liver. So June 2019, there were no tumours and no cancer markers. April 2021, my cancer markers for the colon cancer was 1,964, and it should be under 37.
Good God. So outside of weeing blood, I'm not sure if that's a common sort of symptom for for diagnosis of colon cancer.
No, that's nothing to do. That was just
there's nothing to do with it. So you didn't actually have any sort of asymptomatic, any sort of typical.
I had no symptoms at all for cancer. What I had had was, I could feel cortisol literally streaming through me. I was very removed from reality.
Which is understandable given your son's presence.
But I was putting things in boxes. I was compartmentalising my life so I could work, so I could see Xander, so I could, and I was trying to, I was reading up a lot about, you know, what could help him. I mean, they did finally find out what was wrong with him, and it was bilharzia, and he also had to have chemotherapy actually for that. And he's amazing. He, you know, he's walking again. He's flying again.
Is he? Fantastic.
He's incredible. But there were a couple of months there when my world was collapsing.
Yeah. So essentially, you're essentially suggesting that it was the trauma of your son's paralysis at the time has triggered the cancer diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, it didn't trigger the diagnosis. It triggered the fact.
Sorry, not the diagnosis.
My immune system was so low that it allowed it to take hold, and very quickly.
It's very interesting you say that because I've done a lot of reading, like yourself, obviously, and I've read a lot from a physician, Dr. Gabor Maté, who's a well-known physician and renowned author now, and he claims that trauma contributes to everything. Be that from cancer to ADHD, et cetera, and otherwise. So you're clearly pointing case here with yourself, Lucy.
One of the very most important things for anybody to do in life at all, because of things like stress and trauma, is breathing. Because, you know, we have our two nervous systems, our sympathetic and parasympathetic. And if you can control your breath and you breathe in slowly and breathe out even more slowly, it transfers your body from that fight or flight, filling it with adrenaline and cortisol to get away from your saber-toothed tiger, to being calm and to knowing that you're safe. And that is very important, because if we live in a constant sort of buzz of stress, we are actually burning, we're literally burning the insides of our bodies. We're burning our nerves, we're burning ourselves, we're burning everything. And disease will take hold.
Yeah, of course. So really, some might not agree, but actually Brexit was kind of your saviour to some extent. Because otherwise...
Well, I'm very anti-Brexit, but it did save my life. I have to remind my family when they're ranting about Brexit that there was a good thing that came out of it. I'm still here.
Well, this is it. Well, actually, you mentioned the blood test in itself, and Andrew, who I know we mentioned previously, you know,
Andrew rightly, I think, was suggesting that one should have them, once or twice a year, and I totally agree.
He alluded to that. Well, actually, 100%. Yeah, and then also in a prior sort of previous episode, I spoke to my oncologist George, and I'd always sort of said to him, I said, look, you know, how does one even fathom or go about relaying to their or his patients that you've just been diagnosed with cancer. Now, you know, that's one level. To be sort of suggested that you might be on death's door, I can't even imagine what must
I had a very brutal doctor, the first one I met, who basically my first, I had the colonoscopy thing. It was on a Wednesday night at about 9 o'clock, and a very sweet lady doctor did tell me in Portuguese that I had cancer. And I thought, I don't think I'm really understanding this. And I was like, okay. And she's like, do you understand? I said, yeah, I think I do. I think you're telling me I've got cancer. She's like, yeah. So I had to then go back on the Thursday night and see the doctor that was going to be in charge of me. And he said, right, well, you need to start chemo on Monday. And I was like, no, I don't think I want to do that, actually. I've decided I'm going to do the natural.
Oh, really? So when was that sort of turning point in your head that you thought, well, I've got the doctors giving me chemo?
I've always been anti-chemo. So anyway, I hadn't kind of really realised quite how ill I was. And he said, well, if you don't do that, we can do chemo, surgery, chemo. And if you don't, you'll be dead in 5 months. And I was like, okay, that's not ideal.
Wow. very British.
Very British. But then I did agree to go back for further scans. So the following Tuesday, I had scans of the most likely places for colon cancer to metastasize are your liver and lungs. And right. Mine had. I had 14 tumors in my liver and one in my lung. So at this stage, he was like, actually, I said, so are you still suggesting chemo, operation chemo? And he said, I can't do miracles.
Oh, wow.
And he then said, it's probably more likely 6 weeks than 5 months. And I can't do miracles. Jesus. So I did say to him, I need a doctor who can. And I left. I didn't see him again. I did go back to the oncologist in the hospital to ask what they would suggest, not to necessarily have it, but to find out, because it needed to be part of what I was reading. And then I started to read. Something that came up.
That was your turning point in terms of the sort of the research, the reading, the self-medication, praxis, exceptional advisor.
It was my turning point for knowing I had to find something for cancer. I had through my last sort of 10, 15 years of life, I've been very interested in alternative medical practices. And I had already decided that I wanted to start a retreat here. It's now much more specific that what I want to do. It's now much more to do with teaching about the chronic, you know, how you deal with chronic disease. But so I had already learned quite a lot about alternative medicine. And I think because I've been a producer for so long, I really treated the whole thing a bit like a production. So it's like, right, I need to find out what's available, what works, and put a plan together, which is what I started doing. And I already had some strings to my bow in that through the last few years, I've used things like bioresonance. As a cure for things. Bioresonance is when they run an electric current through you. Everything in life has a frequency and has another frequency that can get rid of it. So whether it be a parasite, a virus, bacteria, and I'm very lucky. There's a very good practitioner very close to me here in Sils. So I'd already gone to see him. And started these right from day one. I already had a very good herbal practitioner, so I had some stuff there for, you know, she put together some tonics for me. I started juicing, but then I also found this extraordinary treatment, which is dendritic cell vaccine.
Right, okay.
And this was,
do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
I'd love to, because this is what I really set my heart on, as saving me. And initially, I thought I was going to have it instead of the
just without skipping. So you met the second, or you went back to the hospital oncologist.
Yeah.
You were reluctant still to do chemotherapy, but he was almost insistent, going, Lucy, I respect and appreciate your...
He didn't respect and appreciate anything that I said. No, he thought I was an idiot.
Right. Okay.
I have subsequently actually changed. I after this moved to Champolimo as my centre of treatment in Portugal, which is an excellent hospital. At the stage that we're talking about, I was still down in the Algarve. But I did find out about dendritic cell. And then I had in my research as well, found out about Champolimo, which is a hospital of excellence in cancer treatment in Portugal. It's a foundation which just deals with cancer. So I made an appointment to go there. I found the doctors there to be much more positive. Weirdly, I don't know if it happened with you, but when I started, the first doctors I saw were surgeons. They were, right. And they then sent you to an oncologist. So I met this surgeon up in Champolimo who, you know, to be fair, said it's the same thing, chemo, surgery, chemo. And I did say to him, I can't do that without 0.4. 0.1, 2 and 3 is great, but 0.4 is needed for me, which is to live a long and happy life. The difference there was that this particular surgeon, broke into a huge smile and said, absolutely, and wrote 0.4 down on his list. And
fantastic. You knew you had the right guy then.
Knew I had the right guy. He then allocated me an oncologist up there who, again, much more positive. Still, you know, I'd say oncologists aren't as cheery as surgeons, but they don't have quite such a cheery, you know, outcome.
Right.
Chemotherapy on its own has a very, very horrific statistic. And one can read this. This is not me. To actually get rid, it's very useful to shrink tumours, but to get rid of tumours, there is only a 2.5% success rate of chemo.
Really? I didn't know that. So I should know that.
You should know that. I mean, it does happen, but it's very rare. What it's very useful at doing is shrinking the tumour. Mm. What our bodies do, what happens when we have cancer and it's out of control, is that the cells in our body, which normally have a sort of lifespan and die, it's called apoptosis, they stop dying. So these cancer cells are just making more and more cells, but they're not dying. And our bodies actually sort of create these tumours to protect us. But cancer is also very adaptive and very clever. And it's then sort of telling the immune system, you need to go and fight something else because we're part of you. So your immune system is now not even fighting cancer. What happened when I discovered the dendritic cell vaccine was that I was introduced to a system whereby they take a blood sample they draw blood from you. It's quite bigger than a sample. It's about 250, 300 millilitres. I felt it was an enormous amount. But
so you just went to the loo. Sorry, I'm bad joke.
It was a huge amount of blood, but it was then from that they grow these cells which are dendritic cells. Dendritic cells I personally term as a sort of general of the immune system. They are the cells which are telling the T cells what to do.
Okay.
So to these newly grown dendritic cells is reintroduced the cancer antigen that's specific to you. It's not just a random, they know what they're telling it. So these reinformed generals are then made into the serum, which is injected back into you. The vaccine, it's done in four injections over a 2-week period. So it's a 2-month thing. It's once every 2 weeks for four things. And what they do is they're sort of reinforming your own immune system how to fight the cancer. To be fair to the people that I went to, at no point did they say do this instead of the allopathic treatment. They said do it in conjunction with. So I did then, having given my lovely clean blood to grow these cells, I then drove back. This was in Spain, so I was just driving backwards and forwards, drove back to Portugal and had my first chemo treatment.
Right.
And I had a cocktail which is called Folfox, which is absolutely horrible.
And everything
I mean, it affects your heart. It's your mouth is full of blood. It's horrific. Again, I didn't want any of the side extra medicines added on. So, for example, with the mouth ulcers, I made I'm very into my herbal teas. I made rosemary tea. Rosemary is the most marvelous herb. It's antibacterial, antiviral, antimicrobial. I used that as a mouthwash. And to be honest, I had very minimal mouth ulcers.
Did you? Yeah. I carried a bottle of cortisol around all the time. I looked like I had sort of liquefied kryptonite.
But that's the problem. It's yet another thing. I am very pro our microbiome. Obviously, by putting chemo into our bodies, it's not ideal for your microbiome. Again, taking the chemo, I took slippery elm each morning, which lines your digestive tract and helps protect your actual digestive tract and your microbiome slightly from the chemo. To be fair, well, I don't know if this is true or not. I was told by the oncologist that the chemo doesn't kill your microbiome quite as dramatically as taking antibiotics. So, you know, but then you don't take antibiotics for 2 years. So,
I don't know exactly. So we're now chemotherapy, dendritic cell vaccine, and many other different sort of medicinal practices that you're undergoing all at the same
interestingly,
time.
Interestingly, the very first chemo I had was prior to having had the vaccine. They'd taken my blood and were growing the what they needed. The first one I had, I really was very ill. I mean, I was lying on the floor vomiting and retching and just looking up at my son saying, I really can't do this. He was rather marvellous, my son, because I've had a few things in my life. And he reminded me that I had been through a few other things and that I could do this. Yes. He was great. My other poor son, I didn't even want to tell because he was about to do his A-levels, so he didn't even know this stage. I told his school, but not him. He was at boarding school in England. So
you started the chemo. I started the chemo.
Yeah. And then what I was doing, I was juicing carrot and beetroot juice every day, which was very high in beta carotene, which helps fight the cancer and also is helping your body be healthier. I was taking the slippery elm. Then when I drove back after the first chemo to Spain and had the actual first injections.
Your oncologist, is there some sort of consultation that needs to be taking place between your oncologist and your dendritic cell vaccination guy, if you like?
The dendritic cell vaccine man was very happy to talk to the oncologist. The oncologist wouldn't speak to him. However, absolutely refused to. So didn't
work. What? Because he was like, you're interfering in my program. Was there a bit of sort of competitiveness?
The thing is, they are any hospital. It has certain treatments which they have agreed are worth having. I think that the dendritic cell vaccine will end up in the hospitals because it's going through a lot of trials. And I'm not the only person who's still here several years later. It's happened to many people, even people with things like
Are there any stats that you can allude to that, you know, sort of testify to the success of dendritic cell vaccination?
No, this is the problem. The pharmaceutical companies that have not taken it on and are not testing it in their way. I mean, there are two centres which do it. One is in Germany, one is in Lithuania. I moved from the German one to the Lithuanian one. They are, the chap in Lithuania, the doctor there, does actually run a cancer centre there. He just works with chemotherapy, he works with radiotherapy, he works with surgery, and he works with dendritic cell vaccine. And other things. He works with IV turmeric. He works with macrophage cells. He works with natural killer cells. He works with interleukin 2. There's quite a barrage of things, many of which I have had. And slowly the data is being put together. Right. I mean, it's cell immunotherapy has been around for 20 years or so, but it's not. It's not going to make loads of money for somebody because it makes you better. It doesn't keep you being medicated for the rest of your life. It heals you. It's not something you're going to carry on taking forever. And if you're better, you're better, and that's it. You're out of the pay thing. I think it's sadly, probably one of the things. However, what I did do with the oncologist was I had a sort of traffic light system whereby I would tell him, I made spreadsheets of everything I was doing, every supplement I was taking, yeah, every treatment I was having. And we had an agreed system where he would read, he, to be fair, was open enough to read about them and would then say, green light, yes, I think that's very good. Orange light, take it if you want, it's not going to affect what I'm doing. Red light, if you do this, it'll actually compromise what I'm doing to you, and therefore don't do both of them, choose
one. What a great guy. I mean, just to have that dialogue with him.
That was actually marvellous. That was very helpful. Yeah. I have got huge spreadsheets of everything I did.
Given your profession, you're sort of well practiced in being methodical.
I'm good at spreadsheets.
Exactly. And so you've got the chemotherapy, the side effects, dendritic cell vaccination. There aren't any sort of known side effects,
There are absolutely none. Of the sort of healthy options, I did the dendritic cell vaccine. I did actually sort of boost that by having a series of macrophage cell injections. Those don't have the specific cancer antigen programmed into them. They just boost your immune system. They are another sort of general from your immune system, the macrophage cells. So I did do a series of those. Those were very simple. I could do those myself. I injected myself every week into my tummy with those. I then also had at one stage some natural killer cells, which are the cord blood cells. They're like a stem cell therapy. Again, those cells are boosting your body, that they are able to be used with whatever your body needs them to be. The stem cell, it could be, you know, stem cells are literally that. They're the starter cells, so they get used by your body to be what the body needs them. So I had a series of those. What I also did have was interleukin injections. Now, the interleukin, interestingly, helps your body absorb whatever it is it's been given and make more use of it. So, funnily enough, the oncologist was quite thrilled about this because he thought it would actually make the chemo work better.
Yeah. That was a massive green light.
That was the only natural thing I had. Well, I don't know how natural it is, but the only one not in hospital that I had that made me feel ill. And I felt flu-y for about 3 days every time I had that, quite ill. Right. But I was having chemo at the same time. So I think, you know, obviously it was quite two things not making me feel great. But I did feel much better with the chemo with having the other things. I didn't ever have that lying on the floor vomiting again.
Experience again. Yeah.
You know? Great. It's meant to get more, you know, worse as you go. And mind.
I can testify to that. I wish I'd met you before. But so now let's go just rewind. We had a 5 week sort of, 6 week, 5 month sort of diagnosis, if you like.
Prognosis.
But now you've started the chemotherapy, you've started your dendritic cell vaccination amongst many other sort of injections and such. Like, how far gone in terms of like the voodoo doll, but how far gone in terms of the process were you before that, you know, we were starting to see signs of recovery, if you like, or actually defeating the cancer?
I have a huge amount of self-belief, which is very lucky. Weirdly, I think I was a set designer with production. And I think I am able to visualize, and it's very important. But so I absolutely thought I was getting better. When I started, my cancer cell count, as I said, for the colon cancer was 1,964. It needs to be below 37. After my first really horrible, you know, into the portal 3 day pump all the rest. They said, listen, you then have a 2 week thing, and it's 2 week from day one to the next day one. So you have 3 days of it solidly and then sort of 11, 12 days off, where I then went back to Spain, had the injection and came back again. They said at that stage, if you're lucky, it'll have gone down about, could have gone down as much as 300. But don't be upset if it's gone up first before it comes down, the mark account.
Mine went
down. My first blood test 2 weeks later had gone from 1964 to 645. Mine had dropped over 1300. They'd ever seen this before. They were kind of gobsmacked. And I continued. So
is there a point there where the oncologist is like, well, yes, I've got my chemotherapy, but what you're doing outside of this is clearly...
No, interestingly, they thought their chemotherapy was working really, really well.
Right. He wasn't prepared to admit, actually, that the dentist...
They thought the chemotherapy was working extremely well. And it, you know, probably was in its way. However... and this continued to go quite well. But after 5 sessions of this, I really didn't think I could take any more of the FOLFOX. I felt it was killing me.
Right.
They told me I absolutely had to keep taking it. Luckily, my son got COVID, so I wasn't allowed to go into the hospital, so I couldn't go in. Having found that, I said, look, I'll just do the blood tests from home. We'll see how I'm going. And I didn't go back for chemo for another, well, actually, I didn't go back. This was beginning of July. My counts were still going down. They were still dropping without having the chemo. In that August, I then had my next scans. And everybody was quite surprised, actually, to see that I still had quite a lot going on in my liver because my bloods were so low by then. Mm. I had had 14 tumours in my liver. When I had a healer near here who said, I don't think you've got 14 now. I think there's only 10 and I think only one is active. In the August, they said, you do still seem to have quite a lot of tumours in your liver. They could see from the scans. We need you to have three or four more sessions of chemo before we can operate. And that was my major breakdown time, actually. That I did lie on his desk and howl and say, if you give me chemo, I will die. I even say I'm not frightened of the cancer, I'm frightened of the chemo. And anyway, they were completely insistent, so I did. The first session I had, I felt like I'd been strangled after it. And I thought this is probably not ideal again. I told them, nobody did anything about it. So I went back for the second one 2 weeks later and I went into anaphylactic shock. I could feel it happening within 10 minutes. It was like I could feel it going from my ears. I'd been left on my own in the room. This was not at Champolimo. This was down here in the Algarve because I could have the doctor up there, but the treatment down here because it was much easier because I was driving myself to the treatments. And I called and called. After about 10 minutes, they came, but I was already unable to breathe through my nose. They were pretty outrageous. They were like, yeah, just calm down, breathe through your nose, stop being panicking. I said, I can't. I'm going into anaphylactic shock. I need adrenaline. And they were awful, really. They were like, we'll tell you what you need. You don't know what's going on. I said, I need the doctor. At least give me my phone. I want to speak to my doctor in Lisbon if you won't get me the doctor here. They finally got me a doctor that I'd never seen before. I'm not sure who he was. I've never seen him before or since. I've never been back to the hospital, to be fair, so I wouldn't have seen him since. But it wasn't wasn't the doctor I'd even started with down there. And I was watching my blood pressure go down. When it went to 30 over 15, I passed out. And then I was resuscitated. I did come round. They said that they could continue to do the chemotherapy.
Oh, God. Music to your ears.
I was like, absolutely not. Don't even touch me. I'm going home. And I never went back there again.
Really?
I did get hold of my doctor in Lisbon. He said, no, don't go back there. This is not good. He said, don't do anything and come and see me in 2 weeks. Just don't do anything. So I went up and they had in that 2 weeks looked at all my scans and decided they'd give it a go doing it. It was very unusual to do what they did to my liver at that stage, but they had they're an amazing hospital. They bring in surgeons from all over the place. So I had this chap from Heidelberg come in to work with the surgeons from Lisbon on my liver, and they removed what was now 10 10 tumours.
Oh, really?
As the healer. All had gone.
Yeah.
And yeah. Of the 10 that were still there, one was not even cancer. Of the 9 remaining, 8 were dead or dying, and only one was active. So the healer had, from his vibrational thing, absolutely nailed it. And it was quite difficult. It's quite a big operation. I hadn't really realised it. I mean, it affects you mentally and everything, but it took me a little while to get over it.
Yeah.
I then went back to chemo for another 3 months.
Right, okay. 3 months. So so chemo, you saw that out, and the dendritic cell vaccination.
The dendritic takes 2 months to reach its sort of peak working.
Right, okay.
It had now reached its peak working, and it continues to be at that peak for at least 9 months.
Oh, okay.
It can keep working for up to 3 years.
Good God. Okay. So we're now progressing even further. You are recovering and beating it, etc. And otherwise, I mean,
well,
I don't even do it justice. Incredibly.
Yeah.
When's the point then? So how far gone are we now since you've sort of no longer been having chemotherapy?
I've had three more surgeries, but 2 more major surgeries since then. And I had chemo. I had chemo until January. Then I had my liver.
Which year are we now?
22. I had chemo till. Then I had major liver surgery in February 22, where they took 70% of my liver out, which turned out to be completely healthy. There was no cancer in it at all.
Oh, God. Right.
That was quite upsetting. I mean, I know I don't feel bad about them, but I wish I'd had the courage to say I think I'm okay. Then they did the colon operation again. There was no cancer left. There was a scar. There was no cancer in that biopsy. So I was sort of given an all clear. And then I came back 3 months later in July. And they said, July 22. And they said, we think you've got cancer in your peritoneal cavity, which is terrible. And this went back. So it was a bit of a roller coaster. So then they went, we've got to do something right. And my mum was dying. And I was like, I've got to go to England. My mum's dying. They said, you can't. You've got to stay here because it will kill you in 3 months if we don't act right now. Now, these were the people in Lisbon who I did trust.
Had a diagnosis already that says 6 weeks to 5 months, and now you've just said, then you have a second one that's saying you don't do anything, you've got 3 months.
Yeah.
Christ.
But, I mean, that's without treatment, obviously, if you have treatment.
Yeah, no, absolutely, but it's still pretty alarming, nonetheless.
So I started again, and this time I was doing 2 lots. I was doing the into the portal and the daily tablets.
Yeah.
So I then literally did from July till December of tablets every single day and every 3 weeks going back to the hospital for more. And I'm going to be honest, it was probably my lowest time actually at that time. I really thought I can't do this anymore. And what they wanted to do was a thing called cytoreductive surgery, which is they really open you up from your breastbone to your pelvic bone. Take everything out of the peritoneal cavity, have a little porridge. It's sort of 12-hour operation. Then they pump hot chemotherapy into your stomach.
I can't imagine you wanted that or did that, just from what we've learned.
What I did do was I went back to the dendritic people and I had a second round of that with all the, bells and whistles. In January, I read about this operation. It's really not a nice one. It has horrible side effects forever. There was a surgeon I wanted to talk to, and they were sort of blocking me getting. They weren't blocking, but they wouldn't tell me how I could get my scans to him. So in a way, they did block me a bit. I was at a very low ebb then. My surgeon at Champolimo was actually amazing, and he was friends with the surgeon, and he did send him my scans personally.
Right.
And actually, what I needed was somebody medical to reinforce what I believed, which was that what I had in my peritoneal cavity was not cancer, but scar tissue, because I had had three huge operations.
So you were adamant it was a scar tissue and there was a sort of...
I was adamant, but not adamant enough to walk away from the hospital, because I also didn't want to die. Although by that Christmas, I wasn't really sure that I wanted to live either. I didn't feel well at all.
Right.
And actually, again, my eldest son said, "I don't give you permission to die, Mummy. I don't." Because I was sort of asking for permission at that stage.
I think we should meet your son in another episode.
My son's amazing. Yeah.
An inspiration as well, yeah.
He's an inspiration. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, he's run the London Marathon for spinal injury because he was paralyzed. Yeah. You know, he's an amazing chap. Yeah. But that's subsequently to being paralyzed. But yeah. So anyway, this surgeon from Basingstoke, this amazing man, did say, "Actually, do you know how awful this operation is?" And I said, "Yeah, I do, but they keep telling me it's not that bad." And he said, "No, it really is as bad as you think it is. And I think, looking at your history, I think you might be right. And if I were you, I wouldn't have it right now. I'd wait. If we were wrong, I would have been dead in 3 months. So what we decided to do was scan again 2 months later, which we did. And I was fine, and I'm still fine. So we scanned in April. So this was February 23, April 23, we scanned again. July 23, we scanned again. December 23, we scanned again. My next scans are in June. I'm fine at the moment. I still juice, but not every day because it's quite hard work. But I do still do the juicing. I'm still very much, you know, organic vegetable-based diet. I don't eat red meat. I eat some white fish and white chicken, white meat, organic. Mm-hmm. You know, I still do my herbal stuff. I still make my teas. The dendritic, because I had it again in 23. I can't remember what year I'm in anymore.
I think 23, I had it. I think.
Yeah, no, we're now in 24. Yeah. I actually, yeah, we are, yeah. So I had the dendritic thing again in October 22. So it is still active. How I had it last time means it's still active. And I have to be honest, for me, I'm very sure. The thing that's amazing with it is it's doing the mopping up, which the chemo can shrink things, but it can't mop up. The dendritic can, because it's your own immune system. And what was fantastic in the hospital was when they did get those two all clear biopsies, is they did say, "Whatever you're doing, keep doing it, because we couldn't have done this."
Incredible.
That they did say.
They were prepared to admit and go, yeah.
Yeah.
So you've kind of gone.
I do believe that it's giving me a second, you know, second go.
Second chance at life. Or third chance at life, given the second diagnosis. So in remission now. Yep.
I'm going one step further. I'm saying I'm clear.
Yes, I love it. Love that attitude. Yes. Let's celebrate that. If I knew what to press on a button to get a round of applause, I'd press it right now. That's fantastic. So, I mean, well, incredible, really. So really, just for anyone listening, and particularly someone who might have been recently diagnosed with colon, as a kind of takeaway, I think clearly dendritic cell vaccination is a big one. Can you just give us a quick...
I actually say, to be fair to dendritic cell, it's many cancers. It's not just colon. There are people with pancreatic cancer, and I don't know if you know about cancers, but that is a horrific one. Even they've got two patients with pancreatic cancer who are still alive 2 or 3 years later. That's amazing.
Wow. It's really a given if we can get access to it. It's not cheap.
It's not cheap, and it's not on insurance. So that's the sad thing about it. And it is sad because it shouldn't be that our health is down to what we can. I mean, I sold my house in England to stay alive.
Wow. Okay. So it really isn't cheap, but
it isn't cheap.
Oh, you're sat here in front of us.
Use all the money. But I mean, it's better to be poor and alive, isn't it, really?
100%.
You forgive everyone.
Great attitude, yeah.
To me or my children or my dad, I would sell everything to stay for any of us to stay alive. Because the thing is, you can always start another life and do more things to stay alive once you are alive. But if you're not alive, it's a bit all over. So it isn't cheap. It's not as expensive as it was 3 years ago because it's becoming more widely used. But I do think if somebody has just had that news, is to absolutely believe that it is not the sentence that it used to be. There is always hope, and that there are so many things that you can do that actually are free. You know, like the juicing, the herbal stuff, and people juice themselves healthy. Dark green leafy vegetables, and beetroot and carrot. It's an interesting one, beetroot and carrot, because obviously they are also high in sugar and sugar feeds cancer. But for me, that was the only sugar I was having. I didn't have any other sugar when I was really ill.
I think you mentioned visualization, you know, manifest and actually see the way out.
Visualization. I do Qigong 3 times a week, which is very, it's about energy healing. It's the warm up for Tai Chi, but it's a very lovely ancient sort of Chinese practice, and that I found incredibly helpful.
Well, my oncologist and I agreed as well. It's just the albeit dreadful times to try and retain that PMA, that positive mental attitude.
It's really really important, and also to acknowledge what may have led you to getting there and try and change that as much as possible, whether it be stress, whether it be bad diet, whether it be whatever the problem may be, is to try.
Trauma, as we sort of, we alluded to earlier.
To sort of acknowledge that yes, it's awful having cancer, but it can also teach you. If you can try and take the positive from it, see what it can teach you and move forward with your new life. With your new life, that is really important.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier about your retreat, which I think, given what we've just learnt today, Lucy, I think you will be oversubscribed as and when that goes live. But just to give us a quick sort of snapshot of what your dreams there, your visualization for the retreat.
My dream there really is that I can sort of, I think everybody has their own journey with any chronic disease, but what I'd like to give them are the tools to take that journey, what to learn, what to look for. There's so much out there, and it's really difficult to find out what's actually real and what's a load of old nonsense, because everybody's allowed to spout whatever nonsense they want on the internet nowadays and say it's true. So I was very lucky. I have a very good friend who's a professor at Imperial College, so I could send papers to Imperial College. They could say these are real and this is nonsense. The dendritic was very, they very much said, yeah, this is the one, go for this one. So that already had science backed,
Coming to your retreat is going to be,
It's going to be an education in nutrition, juicing, herbs, mushrooms. Medicinal mushrooms are amazing. Shagam, turkey tail. Turkey tail is very good for the lung. Funnily enough, I'm actually going on a course tomorrow near us, between us. But I think mushrooms are really important and becoming more understood all the time now. As healing, a healing aids. What we're putting in is vitally important. Keeping moving, even when I was very low, when I was ill, I always would walk 10,000 paces a day. Which isn't very much.
Quite a chore under chemotherapy.
But when you're, also, I mean, if you can, I think, and this is where one is, it's down to luck to an extent. I'm very lucky. I live in a very beautiful place. So when I wasn't in hospital, I was in a beautiful sunny garden. Now, as much as you can, get out into nature. Get, you know, really, there are so many pollutions in the world. Try and just get away from them a bit.
Get away from it, yeah.
You know? But I think it's, and like you were saying, that positive mental attitude, it's so important. Right. Picture yourself better. And not, I will get better. I am healing. I am. It's very much in the present. I am healing.
Great. Yeah. Well, and your testament to that, look at you now, Lisa. So those that can't see, she's a picture of health and beauty. And I can't wait for the retreat to open. Given everything you learnt, would you mind if there's anyone listening that they want to reach out, I can put them on to
you? I'm absolutely, completely happy to speak to anybody. If they want any information, anything I've done, I'm more than happy to share.
You might start getting oversubscribed now, let alone come the retreat. So that's great. Well, listen, I could talk to you forever, and I think I say it to all my guests, you sort of warranted a return invite 100%, and we'd love to speak to your son in due course. He sounds like a true inspiration as well. So, Lucy, thank you so much. As I say, a true inspiration, and just wish you every success and happiness that you clearly deserve moving forward. And I can't wait to meet you in person. We have already agreed that, right?
I'm going to see you in a few weeks' time.
Can't wait. Right, it's in the diary. Let's do it.
Thank you.
Lucy, thank you so much again. And we look forward to seeing you soon.
Bye-bye.
I'm not too sure how to actually put that all into some kind of context, to be honest. Hope is one word that immediately springs to mind. Resilience, strength, determination, perseverance, positivity, you name it. I just don't think there's actually enough adjectives to do justice to describing Lucy and what she's been through. But I do truly hope that Lucy's story does bring some hope to our listeners that may find themselves in a similar situation, as well as inspiration to us all just to never, ever give up, no matter what kind of adversity we might be facing. Now, I know Lucy mentioned getting in touch with her, so if anyone listening did want to, please DM me via our account on Instagram at TalkingToCharlie, and I'd be, of course, delighted to make the necessary introductions. I'm Charlie. This was Talking to Charlie. Be inspired. Keep smiling. Be kind. And I look forward to seeing you all again soon.